spokesman this morning will be Mr. Jim Allen, who's the Vice President of Northwest Alaska from Salt Lake. With him is Mr. Walter Labonte, who's the Managing Partner. And I, excuse me if I may, bother some of the titles. Neil Iser is with him also. We have Attorney Carl Borman from Cahill Gordon. Mr. Johnson from, Ms. Groves from, of course, Senator Groves, former Senator Groves, former Senator Groves, who is one of our advisors in our legal counsel here in Alaska. Mr. Jay Hellstrom from First Boston, who is a financial advisor to our Canadian partners. Howard Pan from Bank of America, financial advisor, and Mike Stanfield from Oak Grove, Kuhn Cornwell.
Thank you, gentlemen. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. At your pleasure, I'm prepared to read or paraphrase a statement that Mr. McMillian made yesterday afternoon for the joint session of the committee.
I'll paraphrase.
Fine. As you know, our company, which was formerly Alcan Pipeline Company, has now been renamed as Northwest Alaskan Pipeline Company. And we are the organization that's been selected by the President with the approval of Congress to design, construct, and operate the Alaskan segment of what we now term the Alaska Highway Pipeline Project. There have been several very positive developments since we have last visited the state and discussed the project. And I might just briefly mention a few of those, and these are both at the Canadian, U.S., federal, state, and provincial levels. There has been a conditional certificate issued to our company and the other companies that are part of the project, which is somewhat unprecedented in its speed of having been issued. I think it was less than a 30-day period, and this does indicate to us a very positive approach on the part of the federal government to do all those things that are necessary and timely to expedite the project's completion. Under the ordinary administrative proceedings of the Federal Power Commission, which is now the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, these sort of proceedings we would have anticipated they would have taken months and months. So it's a very, very positive demonstration that they do in fact intend to expedite the project. They have also established an office of the Alaska Pipeline Project. Mr. John Adrew, I believe, is going to be speaking this afternoon to the same joint session that Mr. McMillian spoke to yesterday, has been appointed director of that office. He will represent both the Department of Energy and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on the Executive Policy Board. There have also been very recent developments in Canada. Legislation was introduced in the Canadian Parliament the early part of February of this year, which would provide the similar centralization of authority necessary to permit the project to go forward on an expedited basis, as has the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Act in the United States. Again, we view this as a very positive. One of the other positive things in the financing area is a indication, a statement by Prime Minister Lougheed of Alberta, province of Alberta, that that province is very interested in participating in the financing of the project. Now, our organization at the same time has been moving forward at the same time that the government areas have, and we are in the process now of in the final negotiation stages of putting together a partnership of U.S. gas transmission companies that will form the foundation of the equity group. As of now, we have six companies that are committed. We're hopeful that there are four or five others that are very interested, and we would hope that within the next 2 weeks we'll be making a formal announcement, and we would hope that we would have a group of some 8 to 10 of these major U.S. gas transmission companies. Now, I would like to get into the subject, our reason for being here, which is the support, the financial support that we'd like to discuss with you in the part of the state of Alaska, and the benefits that we see will accrue to the state and its citizens, and the opportunity for investment that the state would have to realize a similar return as all other investors in the project will. Let me back up one point, and there were certain statements that Mr. McMillian made that weren't in his prepared testimony that are of significance, certainly to the scheduling and the financing of the project that I should also mention. And this relates to the current energy legislation that's pending before Congress. The critical elements of that in terms of our project being able to stay on schedule is the establishment of a wellhead price. We are very hopeful that legislation will be forthcoming within the month. Our intelligence would indicate that a wellhead price in the area of $1.48 to $1.84 would be established for Alaskan North Slope gas. In addition, we would think it would also provide a processing charge in addition to that, be compensated to the producers for the processing function that we would contemplate they would undertake. And one of the most important things in terms of the financing of the project, ensuring the marketability of the gas, is a rolled-in pricing feature that we are also hopeful will be contained in that legislation. Now, if the legislation isn't forthcoming, and we certainly hope it will be, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has indicated they will immediately undertake expedited proceedings to resolve these very critical matters. However, even under expedited proceedings, I think we could anticipate a delay of from 8 to 12 months. Now, in terms of discussing the need for Alaska's financial participation, we do need to, it is important that you understand the project is going to be financed on a project financing basis, and that is the project itself must stand on its own merits as an independent entity. The project's debt service and the return on its equity investors must be provided from the cash flow generated by the project itself. And this is a concept different than what was employed by the major oil companies in the Alyeska crude line. And the basic difference for it is the fact that the financial strength of the U.S. gas transmission companies, even though we anticipate a number of the major companies joining our partnership group, no way does it match the financial strength of the major oil companies that participated in the crude line. And this does make necessary the fact that the funds would be raised on a project financing basis. And we are hopeful and we are confident that we can demonstrate that the project is economically viable in order to permit going forward with this concept. But because of the fact that the private markets are going to be looked to provide most of the financing, there is a need to erase any doubts that may exist and to really generate the continuing interest on the part of the financial community in our project. And we feel this can best be done by working with the financial community and educating them as to the project. And certainly your early and active participation would assist in this effort. Now, as I say, our educational effort is already underway. We have set up a team of advisors and project managers to meet with representatives of the major financial institutions. And one of the prime considerations is to demonstrate to them the significant differences between our project and the Alyeska crude line. We feel that there are very vital and significant differences by reason of the fact that, for example, a haul road does exist to the North Slope. There is a work pad that we would contemplate utilizing. There are existing camp facilities. There are fewer major river crossings. In addition, there is a Yukon River bridge that can accommodate a gas pipeline. And just briefly, that there is a basic infrastructure already in existence that we would anticipate utilizing. The construction requirements themselves should be much simpler. Our project is a refrigerated buried gas pipeline as opposed to a hot oil line, which required considerable insulation. With very few exceptions, the line will be completely buried, whereas about half of the oil line was buried half above ground. So that there are problems of just the structural support for the line, and the frequency of going from above to below ground will be avoided. There's also considerable construction experience that exists because of the number of pipeline contractors that have benefited from the oil line, and certainly we would look to benefit from that experience, and it should help in considerably extent in the efficiency and the ability to control and reduce construction costs. Again, these are just a few examples of the significant differences between our project and the crude line. And as I said, we are in an educational effort with the financial community. We feel we're on the right track, but we also feel that there's a very definite need for us to submit to the financial community some real tangible evidence of the state's conviction that our project is in fact economically sound and that it is different, distinct from the crude line. And your state's participation would demonstrate that you have recognized these differences. Moreover, we feel that a responsive, effective government involvement would assist in keeping the project on schedule and would assure its timely completion. This, again, is important in the views of the financial community. And finally, in the eyes of the financial community, given what I will also discuss as being very substantial financial benefits that would accrue to the state, and also the support that was suggested and perceived by the financial community the support that was suggested for the El Paso project, we feel strongly that a negative response on the part of the state would in fact seriously hinder our efforts to develop confidence in these private markets. Now let me briefly describe what we view as the benefits to the state. These can be categorized as economic, employment, and development benefits. In the economic area, We would calculate that minimum benefits based on production of 2 billion cubic feet a day at a price of $1.45, escalated at a factor of 6% over the 25-year life of the project, would produce royalties in the area of approximately $10 billion, severance taxes of approximately $7 billion, and other taxes, ad valorem, or income taxes, of about $1 billion. Now, if we were to add into that, and we haven't attempted to quantify it, the other taxes related to the gas processing plant, and the income taxes related to the sale of the gas, we would, the total benefits would substantially exceed $20 billion. Again, these are what we would consider minimum benefits. In the employment area, during the construction period of 79 to 82, the number of jobs created will range from 1,300 to more than 10,000. The project is committed to hiring qualified Alaskans, and after its completion, there will be a permanent staff located in the state. The indirect benefits include various other services that are necessary to support the project. These would provide additional employment and revenue stemming from housing, communications, and transportation, and so forth. And they would furthermore be multiplied as these benefits circulate throughout the state's economy. As far as the development benefits, our project will stimulate further exploration and development of Alaska's North Slope gas, will allow for the distribution of this gas to the communities along the route, and will provide an energy base supply for future industrial development. Summary, we feel that the project generates very real, substantial, and continuing economic benefits. And by the state providing its early financial support, the state itself will accelerate the realization of these benefits. I think it's fair to say that the project is not built. None of these benefits will be realized by the state. In terms of how the state can assist us, before I get into some rather specific items, I think it is important to note that the current administration in Washington has taken a very strong position that not only this project, but any other major energy supply project, whether it's LNG, SNG, coal gasification, nuclear projects, will not be financed on the basis of federal loan guarantees. As I mentioned previously, our project will be financed on a project financing basis, and in connection therewith, we would contemplate acquiring a committed pool of capital, assembling a committed pool of capital sufficiently large to assure all lenders and investors that the funds are sufficient to complete the project. This pool would be made up basically of equity of approximately 25% and the remainder in debt. Now, most of the equity is going to be what to our U.S. gas transmission companies that will be our partners in this. However, we do welcome participation by the state, its citizens, its native corporations, and other state organizations participating in the equity. While most of the debt financing will be provided by the private markets and principally banks and insurance companies, we do expect, and this was pointed out in the President's report to Congress, that it is anticipated that the other project parties benefiting would participate in this segment of the financing. Now, to be specific, we would encourage the state's financial support in the range of $1.2 to $1.4 billion, and this commitment would include both purchases of debt and equity, and is consistent with what the state has suggested for the El Paso project in the past, adjusted for inflation. The state's commitment would be limited to a fixed amount, and would receive a return on its debt and return on its equity investment identical to that received by all other investors. The commitment would not be binding until all of the capital necessary to assure completion has been committed. And finally, most importantly, we look to the ultimate backing for the state's financial participation to be the revenues generated from the project itself, to include the royalties and other related taxes referred to earlier. Interim backing could be obtained from a number of sources. Our financial and legal advisors have examined this. They are here. And we would certainly welcome working with you, others within the executive branch, to accomplish this. And we would hope that, well, we really do hope that by our visit here, we've been able to impart a better understanding not only of the project in general, but also its very real economic and employment development benefits to the state. And we do look forward during this session of the legislature, and I should emphasize, in order for us to stay on a schedule of being in service by January 1, '83, we view it very necessary for the state to take action this session of the legislature in terms of its financial participation. Thank you for the opportunity, and we stand ready to answer any and all questions.
How large of a pool are you trying to put together?
Walter, do you like to speak to that?
The exact number has not yet been determined because of the, at the moment, we have not had the detailed estimates of engineering, et cetera, necessary to construct the pipeline. However, we would anticipate that there would be a fund that would certainly take care of the basic construction together with assuring the investor that there are sufficient funds to take care of unforeseen and unexpected problems that might arise in the construction. Just for the sake of illustration, let's assume, as we affirm reasonably, the basic cost of the Alaskan segment would be approximately $4 billion. We would anticipate a substantial cushion over and above that, somewhere in the neighborhood that I would suggest maybe 25% or thereabouts. It's very difficult to become specific at this moment.
Well, you've become quite specific in terms of what the state should participate in.
Well,
make up 10%, 25%? How did you arrive at our figure?
Well, we arrived at your figure by obviously starting from the basis under which the suggested financial assistance was to be granted to the El Paso line and added on an escalating factor until the time of takedown. That's why we felt that if the state had explored the possibilities of investing $900 million in the El Paso line, we felt that we should certainly be worthy of the same type of consideration.
I see. What specifically are you referring to in terms of the 900 million? Whose proposal was that?
Well, as we understand it, it was a resolution of the joint houses, however, subject to certain conditions. And obviously, when the El Paso project collapsed, that resolution also collapsed.
I think this
Mr. Bornman also can address himself.
Darrell Bornman.
Yeah, I understand there was also a letter sent by the Commissioner of Revenue to the company, which was submitted to the Federal Power Commission in connection with the approval of the project during the hearings at the time.
Could you get us a copy of that letter?
We are endeavoring to do so.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember the resolution.
I think you're referring to the sale of our royalty gas as a part of the El Paso route.
Mr. Chairman, the resolution dealt with the feasibility of the financial participation. On the basis of the resolution, the Commissioner of Revenue wrote a letter to the FPC. That letter has created some problems for everybody. But in any event, Mr. Chairman, the testimony before the FPC also was total amount of the capital required would be in the range of 10 to 12 billion.
I think, as I tried to point out, the important thing is the perception that not only the federal government has as a result of the proceeding where this was introduced, but the president's report and also the financial community, that this type support would be forthcoming with regard to the El Paso project.
Yesterday you mentioned that what the method that you anticipated was the revenue bonds being sold and tied to production royalty. One of the questions that I believe Commissioner Gallagher brought up was the constitutionality of that. Have you checked into that yet?
Mr. Chairman, I am meeting with Mr. Groh, with the Attorney General, later this morning after this meeting, and we're going to discuss that and other features and possibilities of how financing could be brought about.
Okay, what did you anticipate within financing?
Let me emphasize that the concept of revenue bonds is just one of many possible suggestions that can be worked out. The fundamental purpose of our trip this time would be to hope to establish a working group with members of the, or representatives of the House and the Senate and the Executive, so that we can work together in a method of coming up with a financing plan that will be well within the yardsticks that we have set down for our for the source of funds from the state of Alaska, and that being the production of natural gas itself and royalty and other tax interest.
Okay, you mentioned that you have some ideas as to interfinancing. Financing.
Yes, we do.
Where are they?
Well, Neil, you can address yourself on that if you wish.
The concept has been outlined so far, and we're making a couple of assumptions by stepping into the middle of this. The first assumption is that the state would not wish to finance out of cash or a cash pool that it might have one sort or another, but that it might wish to purchase its interest, and the state's been offered equity and debt the same as any other investor. Might wish to purchase this interest through the issuance of its own debt. And I believe it's also been expressed that the state would like to do this through a vehicle so that the debt with which it issues to purchase into the project is paid off by the revenues that the state receives from the project. Now, if the state is purchasing, to make it simple, the state is purchasing debt from the project. Debt from the project will have an interest rate and it'll have a principal repayment. And if the state were to issue its own debt at the same interest rate, you can see that the revenue that it would receive from holding the debt and getting an interest rate on that debt from the project would more or less be the same as the debt it would issue. So that the revenues from the project would be paying off any debt that the state might wish to issue. Now, you've talked about interim financing, and I suspect what you mean by that is that the project won't pay off until it's completed. And in issuing debt to finance a project such as this, you generally prepay or pre-fund the early interest payment and the early principal retirement, so that principal and interest don't begin until revenues begin flowing through the pipeline and into the project. And I assume that's what you're referring to, is how does the state bridge this early period? And we've thought of several alternatives, and they're very tentative alternatives, because at this point we have to sit down with the various functional people in the state and delve further into them. To give an idea of the range of our thinking, we've ranged from some sort of security interest on the gas as it exists in the ground right now. In other words, the state has a right to 12.5% of the gas that comes out of the ground, as I presently understand it. Now, that would lead one to believe that the state would have a security interest on the gas that's in the ground, regardless of when it comes out, because it's fairly assured that it will eventually come out. And that security interest is, of course, on a major asset, the amount of the gas, which one has a pretty good idea how much gas there is in there. And it may be possible to utilize this, which is, so to speak, the inchoate, unrealized value of the gas that's in the ground up there, to support the state's investment during the period, the early construction period, or the period before the gas actually begins flowing through the pipeline.
The subject of borrowing money on the basis of proven reserves is certainly one that's commonly used by anyone in the oil and gas.
We're familiar with it.
Yeah. Yeah, we tax
the same thing.
And so what we're suggesting is we use this vehicle, but using the state or an agency thereof.
Now, there are other vehicles. There are funds that may be desirable in addition to this security, or instead of this security, for the state to set up a fund. In other words, I would think that the market's going to look to the security with which the state will be able to repay the bonds which it issues to purchase its interest in the project. And another proven method of supporting bonds during the early period before the revenues from the project come in is through a reserve fund. Now, the reserve fund doesn't have to be as large as the bonds itself. It can be much less, depending upon the perception in the minds of the investor as to how soon, or how late, rather, the construction of the project may be delayed. Now, that clearly is a number that we cannot come up with, or even pretend to come up with, until we've spoken with investors. And another possibility is a moral obligation. And a moral obligation of the state is a financing mechanism which, as you know, had been used and kicked around a bit in the late 60s and very early 70s in certain eastern cities. And in this case, I think it may have some value, because the moral obligation coupled with the security interest on the gas, there's a co-ate security interest on the gas, which is on the North Slope, may lift the moral obligation out of the speculative realm in terms of the potential purchases of your securities, and place it in, shore up the security of your obligation. Now, those are three different kinds of thoughts which we've had. One, the inchoate value of the gas. The other, setting up a debt service reserve of one sort or another. And the third, a moral obligation.
Okay. The one thing that bothered me from yesterday's conversations, two things actually, that you haven't talked about yet. The first is, I'm still curious as to why the owners of the gas are so reluctant to participate in the construction of the line. And I heard your answer yesterday, but I'm not satisfied with it yet.
I don't think that, Senator, that we indicated the reluctance. I think what was attempted to be indicated was that there has been no dialogue yet.
Well, I say reluctance only to the extent that you had contacted certain ones of them, according to McMillian, and each one had said no for a variety of reasons.
I think one thing of importance is the fact that the President's report approved by Congress prohibits the producers from taking an equity position in the project, so that whatever financial position they make, they would take, it's going to be other than an equity position. I think it's also fair to say that the reluctance on the part of the producers is directly tied to the delay in establishing a wellhead price, and that before that happens, we really can't sit down and not only talk about their financial participation, but also the contracting for that gas with the U.S. transmission companies. So I really think the reluctance is more tied to that than anything else.
If they're reluctant,
well, that's not the right term. It's not a reluctance. It's a matter of the appropriate time, and the time is not appropriate yet.
You might get into some pricing, discussion of pricing, because I don't think you did it initially.
Well, this was not in Mr. McMillian's prepared testimony, but I think he did comment on the importance of the energy legislation and the pricing provisions of that, particularly as to the financing and the scheduling of our project. But it also does relate to the time that it would be appropriate to meet with the producers in terms of their financial participation.
In terms of specifics, it's our best estimate at the moment that the price of old gas is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.48 to $1.82, or in that range. It's very difficult to obviously predict what's going to happen as a result of the joint committees which are presently holding a conference, operate to report to both houses. But that's our best estimate, and on good basis. If that bill does not pass, or there is no energy legislation, and the FERC indicated that they would take immediate action and attempt to establish a price. And if they establish a price, a great number of different parameters would hold forth. And indeed, they would be operating under the existing law. And that existing law could, in fact, bring the price of the gas paid at the wellhead to somewhere in the neighborhood, as I recall, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 50 cents. Is that right, Jim?
Well, I think we would anticipate, because of the fact that, that the FERC, what used to be the FPC, is bound to establish price on a cost basis, that under a reasonable cost oriented type approach to establishing that the wellhead price, both the wellhead price and an estimate of what the processing charge would be, we would anticipate it would not exceed a dollar, somewhere in the 90 cent to a dollar range. So that certainly that's also significance to the state in terms of the economic benefits that the state will realize because of the establishment of the price.
Okay, Senator Tillion?
I'm on a slightly different one. I get this processing cost, but I'm somewhat rattled. You talked about a refrigerated line. I'm just wondering how much is going to be scrubbed out of this gas and left behind. What kind of gas are you going to be moving? Is this going to be refrigerated enough to move it as liquid, or is it going to be a dry gas?
No,
it's going to be a dry gas line, isn't it?
It has to be pipeline quality, remain in a gaseous state in order for it to be transported through the system. Now, we have always contemplated our project would start from the tailgate of the processing plant. We've also contemplated the responsibility for the construction of that plant to remove whatever liquids are necessary to be removed to make the gas transportable would be the responsibility of the producer. Now, the question of the compensation of the producers is something else, and that's either going to be spoken to general terms in the legislation or by the FERC.
A number of us are interested in petrochemicals, so how much you scrub out of it is of real interest to us, because it might be that any petrochemical plant that we're interested in is going to have to be at the oil line. You know, how much you're going to take out of the gas?
Natural gas, as you know, is methane.
Yeah.
And what they do is take out the propane, the ethanes, and the butanes up there. In addition to that, there's a very large CO2 content in the gas, which has to be removed from the line. So there has to be a processing of the gas in order to put it in the pipeline itself.
Yes, but the warmer your, in other words, the colder your line.
The only difference is that gas has to be kept at a temperature that permits gasification. When you get down to liquid by petroleum gas, you're getting down to somewhere in the neighborhood of 258 degrees below zero.
Oh, that's if you liquefy the whole thing, right?
No,
but the thing is that the cooler you get it, the more
the
warmer it is, the more liquid you've got to scrub out.
I'm certainly not an engineer, but this is the first time I've ever even heard a relationship of the cooling to the liquid extraction of it. there may be a relationship.
I'm not any expert on it, but the thing is that we're going to have to find what gets scrubbed out and what the state does with what's scrubbed out.
Well, that would be owned by the producers.
Right. Mm-hmm. We in no way have ever contemplated us being involved with that processing plant.
You would have your royalty interest to the extent that that gas is used and by the virtue of the processing plant, and that would have to, I would assume, be negotiated with the producers.
Right, right. There'll be some, you know, anything that's liquid, if it can come down in the oil line. But there's a big difference to how much you scrub out and how much propane we have left over, stuff like that. And I'm no engineer, but
I think we can get them that information.
I sure would like the information.
An MCF basis, how much of it would be propane, butanes?
Yeah, I
Senator Orsini?
You mentioned something about an 8 to 12 month delay in the early part of your statements.
Well, yeah, let me clarify that. And we are very hopeful that the energy legislation will be coming forward within the month, which will establish the wellhead price and speak to this question. It is very critical of the role in pricing in order to make our product marketable. In the event that legislation isn't forthcoming, then I think as both Walter and I spoke to, the FERC is prepared to immediately institute proceedings, which would be this cost-oriented, cost-basis type proceeding. But that in itself, even though it's expedited, we would anticipate would create a delay of anywhere from 8 to 12 months.
Basically, you lose the construction season. Instead of starting construction in the summer or early spring of 79, you didn't start construction until...
Well, I think instead of a completion date of January 83, we'd be looking at a completion date of about 84, January 84.
Then, assuming that the legislation is passed, you start gearing up for construction sometime the end of 1978, early 1979, and begin construction.
Well, let me briefly. I'm not an engineer. Let me
okay.
Just describe what.
Let me give you a couple more questions I have in that regard. You can address them at the same time. From what I understand in the papers, that the Canadian natives are not satisfied with any settlements they have, and are prepared to do a number of things to prevent construction until the settlements are satisfied. I'm going to address that. There are also various requirements for impact studies of all different kinds. Are they undergoing now, or they will be undergone once some sort of an okay is given, or what's the timing of those studies?
Well, let me speak to just our overall plan of construction here, which is basically a five-year period. And in order to have the project in service by January 83, there are 2 years of hard construction, actually laying of the line, the construction installation of the compressor station. That would take place in the years 81 and 82. The year 1980, we would look to the civil construction work necessary, roads, communication systems, the bringing in of the necessary materials. So that the years 78 and 9, and we are very deeply involved in this right now, in whatever engineering, design, work, pre-construction activities are necessary in order to meet that schedule of an in-service date of January 83. We contemplate and are budgeting expenditures of $200 million that would be funded by this partnership group over the next 2 years of 78 to 79 in order to engage in those activities. Now, these impact statements and such that you referred to are all part of the work that's ongoing right now. The other one, I'd like Jay Hellstrom here, who's from First Boston Corporation, representing our Canadian partners, to speak to. I think Jay is much more knowledgeable in that area, certainly, than I am.
Speaking specifically to the Native Plains, there has been a continuing dialogue, constructive negotiations, which broke off in December for the holidays and will commence shortly. so that in the sense of discussions, they are continuing and they feel that they are making progress on them. I think there are a couple of important additional factors that one has to relate into that question, which is a good one. First, legislation has been introduced, as I think Jim mentioned, in Parliament, and it's in its second reading. In that, it's important to note that there is a section in the legislation which speaks to the jurisdiction and the right of authority, legal authority, being held by the Northern Pipeline Commission, and it relates to the federal court system. And to cut it short, what it says is that there's one and only one court of last resort, and that's the federal court. And while injunctions can be made, progress of construction on the pipeline will not be held up, and that these will be court cases presented to the federal court and decisions made, and those are final. There will be no other right in progress beyond that court to hold up. And once construction of this pipeline has started, it cannot be stopped except through this federal court system. That's a very significant item in the legislation that deals specifically, I think, with the native claim. Secondly, the section of this pipeline in Canada is one much simpler to build because of the knowledge of the terrain in the southern part, if you will, in the province of Alberta and BC. It's an existing pipeline territory, and they built a lot of pipelines there in those two existing systems. They will be built first if you look at the construction schedule under advanced building. The last in the native claim section speaks to the Yukon. Is that portion which will be, if you will, later on in the system of the construction, leaving sufficient time to continue the negotiations with the native claim and working toward a resolution so that you have more time for that section to work on that particular part of negotiations as it applies to the overall construction program of the pipeline. So those two things I've heard.
Well, what's been the progress of this legislation in Canada?
As it was introduced approximately 2.5 weeks ago. On Monday, it had its second reading, as they call it, its pre-reading. And it's been good progress. It's a healthy debate, if you can well imagine. But
the
all
committees have been working on it. I'm not familiar with Canadian system.
No, that's Parliament.
It's a parliamentary system. It's introduced by the executive branch, which it was 2.5 weeks ago. It had a second reading, which started this last Monday. There'll be debate on this second reading for approximately 2 to 3 weeks. It'll have its third reading and then be, if you will, signed by all of this is on a fast track, anticipating that wound down sometime in the latter part of this first quarter or early part of the second quarter.
Jay, isn't it fair to say that
early April, is that when you sort of expect a yes or no?
Yeah, April to May. See, it's important. Trudeau has the power, if you will, by being the majority party, to pass this. And this is a more of a formality, if you will, to give the opposition an opportunity to close this. But they put it in and basically it passed.
It's a new couple.
It's a different type of government. It's basically a more important government when it comes to legislation.
Senator Chilean?
I understand the powers they've got on the Yukon. You know, the federal have that. You don't foresee any difficulties with any of the provinces under the Canadian system. There's certain things the federal can't do to a province.
That's correct. But again, here, the legislation speaks to that issue, which is one of trying to have each province, and there are three, it's BC, Alberta, and Saskatchewan, work in unison, which has been the case today. I mean, you look at Lockheed and the other prime ministers from the province, and they've all very much been involved in this decision that was reached, and they will continue to be. And there's been a commission set up under the Northern Pipeline to have the provinces involved in the decision-making process of running the overall pipeline. So this is part of the legislation which was introduced to speak to that issue. There's been good progress made as far as, I think Jim mentioned, these provinces view this as a very important project for their provinces and are taking an active interest in it. In the case of province of Alberta through the Heritage Mine has indicated an interest in participating in the financing side of this, i.e. the loan side, to give you an indication of their involvement. I think in addition, they continue to work on the right-of-way if somebody had alarm tags and the like. Most of this has been worked out through discussion, which then went into the heads of agreement or between the United States and Canada.
Well, I would expect no trouble with BC or Alberta. Saskatchewan is...
Very small factor. If you look at it, the amount of pipeline that would be built there, roughly 100 million, it's very, very small. As far as the involvement of the Saskatchewan government, they have been actively in all of these discussions, constructive. They haven't impeded any of the developments that's worked up through the NEB. And of course, you understand this is all controlled as to the pipeline by the National Energy Board. The provinces only have a relationship as it relates to taxes.
Yes, but they have the power of almost prohibiting taxes if they don't want something.
But they, while not being signatories of the agreement, if you look at the discussion that went on between the State Department and the federal government, they had been involved in the communication back and forth.
You feel that getting their active cooperation is not difficult?
Yeah, Howard points out that there were letters that were in communication paths, but of a private nature between the provinces and the federal government throughout this entire process. And that then was wrapped into the agreement worked out between Canada and the United States and the overall heads of agreement agreed by the two countries.
Doesn't your position regarding the respective names get weaker as time goes on? You said you can construct this last.
See, the federal government can say this is it.
Yeah. They have more power over their natives than we have over ours. But
they can make the final decision just as they did in the James Bay decision and say that's it.
Do you have enough power over the native to stick a hand right?
No, you don't. I mean, I don't think we have. You know, I think it was a
Let's assume for a minute that you do get a group of people in the government here in Alaska that are interested in pursuing this. Do you have any specific proposals as to how any particular type of legislation, resolution, contracts, agreements, etc.? Have you thought of this in terms of how you would proceed with your proposal?
I don't believe we have it now, Carl.
We have explored the limited resources we have with respect to Alaskan law, basically your constitution and the Alaskan statute, and we've done an analysis, have come up with various alternatives, which some could require a constitutional amendment, some could require a referendum, some could require just simple statutory amendments, and obviously we want to go a route that is simple, not complicated, and as less disruptive as possible. And this is what I'm going to explore with the Attorney General later today.
Okay, so you should have something concrete by...
So the answer is that we have nothing specific, but we have a list of alternatives and alternative routes, and what we're going to try to do is get together with law department, specifically the Attorney General, and see what really makes more sense and what is going to work with at least resistance.
When do you think you'll have it?
After my discussion with the Attorney General. Sometime next week, I would imagine.
Sometime next week?
Yeah.
Well, I think that part of the format decision, which is to say, once a financing mechanism for the state's involvement has been determined, then what kind of a mechanism should be put through the legislature, that has to wait the decision of the state's involvement. I mean, just to pick an example, if they decide to set up a separate authority somehow or other, well, then that's clearly going to need some special sort of legislation setting up an authority. If, on the other hand, it wishes to purchase, keep it simple and perhaps just purchase an interest in the project, it might be possible to do it with a simple joint resolution. I don't think that the final determination of how formal we have to go can be made, in other words, until we determine what the precise form of the state's involvement will be with the project.
Okay, it's kind of that precise.
By way of timing, Senator, let me point this out. let me point this out, that the actual takedown of funds reflecting the investment of Alaska and other investors would probably not take place until late 79 or late 80. However, in order for us to formulate our plans for the financing, we would like to have, as forcefully as possible, an expression of interest or a commitment subject to certain contingencies or conditions by the state to participate in the project, if you follow me.
In this session.
Well, the attention's of no value to you because you've got a new legislature and maybe a new administration before you come back. So only a commitment is of any value.
Well, we would suggest a commitment subject to obviously prudent conditions. That is, if we have sufficient funds to demonstrate to you that we can construct the pipeline, just like any other investor. You would be investing along the same guidelines as every other investor. And that investor's funds would not be taken down until they are reasonably assured that there are sufficient funds to complete the construction of the pipeline.
Okay, we're going to have to recess in order to go into session. There's one thing I'd like to state that I think you should be aware of, and it's something that I think you've made a mistake in again, but I can realize it because you've been at Sears and not familiar with it. There are a lot of people, legislators and Alaskans, who have little concern about money and how it's spent unless they can see something for it. And not once this morning have you mentioned employment, which is an extremely important factor up here. And I don't mean American employment, I mean Alaskan employment. And all you have to do is go back and look at the problems that we had with construction of the Alaska pipeline. I think that's one area that you're going to find greater concern than you realize right now, because it's not something that's connected with billions of dollars or millions of dollars, but it's an extremely important factor up here. The other point that you might also consider as a part of this program, again, is in the petrochemical industry, which again is tied to employment.
Well, I didn't give enough emphasis in my remarks.
That's what I'm saying, is that with the royalty oil proposals, they never gave very much emphasis except to one paragraph by stating they were going to have it, and I just hope you don't make that mistake.
Want to know, like, how many?
Are
Americans.
Again, I mentioned that during this total construction period, we're looking at from 1,300 to over 10,000. We are committed to hiring qualified Alaskans.
It's not good enough.
I think this point came up at yesterday's hearing, and certainly we welcome the opportunity to meet with the appropriate state people who have those responsibilities. See what's necessary in advance to set up a training program, if you will, that we can utilize to the maximum extent possible the services of the citizens.
I think that if you're going to get the legislature to look at this in any light at all, you're going to have to put the highest priority on this.
In other words, we don't claim our people are qualified. If you're talking about qualified people, you're going to hire out of Texas and Oklahoma.
This point came up in terms of what plans do we have for training, and we feel there is sufficient time to establish a training program whereby the people will be qualified.
I think it's fair to say that we have presently in existence, a personnel department. They're very cognizant, and we thank you for your concern, because we're very cognizant of that too. Of the necessity to employ Alaskan laborers for the construction of the pipeline. And in that connection, we would be prepared to have training programs and other things so that when it's time to employ these individuals and put in the work, they would be qualified to do so. In terms of being specifics, I think, we have a critical path study that would indicate, for example, the amount of peoples that would be employed under certain conditions and by certain contractors. And I'm quite sure that we can work in conjunction with your offices here to satisfy you of our desire and indeed probably and the fulfillment of Alaskan employees. But I can't say to you that by 1980 we're going to be employing 8,000 Alaskans, because at that particular time, I must confess, we don't have the information here.
Chairman, just to follow up on that, how many Alaskans are you employing now?
Now?
Now.
Well, I would.
We have more than.
We have a number here.
Because we have a lot of professional firms in the state that have a lot of expertise.
If I may, Senator, currently the level of activity is one where we're doing engineering and a lot of geotechnical seismic work. All the
Alaskan firms are using those.
All of the work that you've done in Alaska today, the great majority of it have been with Alaskan firms, and the reason I'm a very specific center, I don't believe we've used an outside firm to do any of our geotechnical work in Alaska. We've done some surveying work, and majority of our work in the interim is delta to the border where there isn't a lot of information, and we've done some surveying work that went to an Alaskan firm. We're doing some exploration work in ground temperature to determine where to put the line.
My concern, I think, is beyond just once construction starts, it's all, and all this pre-phase, $200 million. It'd be nice to have some of that money in the state also.
I think it'd be safe to say, Senator, I recognize the time constraints. Let me respond somewhat to help Senator Sackett's question. We've retained some of the people that worked on the Alyeska project that were involved in training. We take this up very, very carefully with the Department of Labor and with the particularly Native organizations in the state to try to determine who did the best job of employing Alaskans. And we're pulling some of those people out of Alyeska now to work on our EDO plan and our affirmative action plan. The next step is to work on a training program. So that work is underway.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call the meeting to order.
Last year we passed in the legislature a committee substitute for House Bill 117, which was originally introduced by Cruiser, and said by the 45th day, which is next Wednesday, the legislature shall have established by concurrent resolution the total amount of state general funds that shall be available for appropriation for the budget year, and tentative allocation of the funds among program categories in both the operating and capital budgets. The resolution shall be introduced by the Finance Committee of the House in which the general appropriation bill is introduced. That's the part that refers to HCR 97. The bill resolution that came over, you have in there, and basically what they did was to take the total amount of revenue for 79 plus the 18 million in the renewable resource and say that was available for appropriation. Then they took the estimate of the liquid surplus in the general fund balance, which is approximately one half of the total amount that's available. The other half is tied up with veterans loans, et cetera, at this point in time. And then on the back of the page, they allocated the $946,600,000 on a percentage basis according to the categories that we have in the budget. And then in the last resolve clause, they indicated that if the legislature clearly stands, changes its policy regarding capital projects, makes a major shift to fund such projects by direct appropriation for the general fund in lieu of authorizing general obligation bonds, and if the legislature also passes new revenue measures sufficient to fund these direct appropriations, an additional $150 million shall be available for capital appropriation. Then they have a short clause at the end that says that this resolution may be amended because of major unforeseen events or genuine emergencies. So that came over last week, and what we've done is to verify, first of all of the funds that are available. And Judy, you might go into some detailed discussion of this.
The sources of funds that they used in the House concurrent resolution came from the governor's budget and revenue source fund. And I talked with the Department of Revenue yesterday, and although they are revising some projections, they said they won't have anything updated until about the 15th of March. And that currently they are staying by what is in the governor's revenue source fund. And they say at this time they can't. They have no basis for changing them, although they're working on changes that they anticipate will be revised by the middle of next month.
Well, we just lost a fair bit of revenue with a little hole in the pipeline, didn't we?
They're not going to
run at half speed anyway. It's bound to have an impact on the big general fund.
Yeah, that's true, but
as on mine, I know. The pipeline will be.
We're not going to revise until March because they anticipate, I believe, also that at the end of this year we're going to have more than what's projected for this fiscal year, which would, of course, spill over to the next year. And but they will not revise it until probably it actually happens. Okay, there were a couple of changes that we found that probably are necessary. Yeah, I'm going to pass out the work draft of a committee substitute. We did an analysis of all of the percentages that they had derived for the different categories. And in trying to do this, we tried to anticipate all possible changes that might occur in the budget, which is next to impossible. However, we came up with slight variations in what they have, in only two areas in terms of total percentages. Education, as you know, is underfunded approximately $11 million in the governor's budget in terms of, is it three specific kind of areas?
Thanks, sir.
Community.
It would be in public transportation, community schools, school bus program, and
veteran. Okay, so if the legislature wanted to, we did analysis of that. However, it still falls to 44%. And so we tried to anticipate what might occur in any of the other categories also. So the only changes that you see would be under natural resources, of a 1% change, and development of a 1% change downwards, natural resources going up. In natural resources, I think you want to say.
Where would you drop the other percent?
Okay, what other thing that you think that is?
Okay. Basically, the things that I took into consideration when I was trying to come up with some round totals was I estimated on advice from Dave that it was quite possible that education, if it were fully funded and taking into consideration some new legislation which has been submitted, and it's hard to tell on some of those because there has yet been no fiscal notes, that we added on another $15 million to education to the governor's budget because of the underfunding and the possibilities of new programs. And it's still, as the chairman said, stayed at 44%. In social services, there's an AFDC bill, which would add approximately $3 million general funds on. And then the only other one was transportation, projecting a possible $6 million for the haul road maintenance. And working on those, on the basis of those figures, in round percentages, development and natural resources were the only ones that changed. I don't know how or on what basis the House figures developed the 6% for both categories, but when I looked it out with the round figures that I was working on, it came out to 5 for development and 7 for natural resources.
In addition to that, the House had in capital improvements just 1% for natural resources, 1% for development. Those funds came out of the governor's budget, and they were all of the renewable resource funds that the governor had. If you look at the budget for 79, you'll find that there are no capital improvements whatsoever, except for those two in the governor's budget. And I anticipate that there's going to be a lot of requests for small projects that utilize general funds, say 20,000 here, 40,000 there, that are not going to go into bond issues. So what I proposed is that there's another resolve clause in there that resolve that these percentages are rounded to the nearest whole, and that 0% is anything less than 0.5%, meaning that in any one of the capital projects, you can go up to $5 million total if it says 0. And if it's 1%, it would go up to $9 million. So that gives you leeway. You don't have to go up to $4 million. You have to even put 0. But if you go by the House method of 0, that means you're stuck to 0, even if you have a $20,000 budget. Go ahead.
Sure. What requirement is there that we do this percentage business? I know that's part of the resolution.
I'll read it to you again. That shall be available for appropriation for the budget year, and tentative allocation of the funds among program categories in both the operating and capital budgets. So we took the allocations according to categories. And I think percentages are probably the only thing that you come close to. 1% comes out to $9 million.
What I was concerned about is that if we thought, when the pressure will now be on us in each of these areas, that, well, we've got 9% or $90 million for justice, let's spend it all. But we think that some item perhaps should be cut from the budget, then there's going to be some other pressure from some other portion of, of that budget to increase. And besides giving us a ceiling, it gives us a floor.
I don't look at this group as a floor.
And certainly, if we feel that some category ought to be have a little bit less, does that automatically mean that some other category gets more?
No.
Not if you do it this way.
No, it's a ceiling. I voted against this bill last year, but we're stuck with it.
I like that.
I don't feel No. Okay, the other change that I recommend is on the last, next to the last resolve clause. They had in there, if the legislature clearly changes its policy regarding capital projects and makes a major shift to fund such projects by direct appropriation from the general fund in lieu of authorizing general obligation bond, and if the legislature also passes new revenue measures sufficient to fund these direct appropriations, an additional $150 million. And change it so that
when you're reading it,
okay, that's next to the last resolve clause, next page. I'm reading what the House
had.
And I changed it that if the legislature changes the policy regarding capital projects and makes the shift to fund such projects by direct appropriation of the general fund in addition to authorizing general obligation bonds in addition to 150 million shall be available in appropriations. And further resolves that this resolution may be amended because of unforeseeable events and emergencies, but I didn't know what major unforeseen events were, and I didn't know what genuine emergencies were. It's like a redundant. And the reason I did that in that next to the last resolve clause is that I think it allows the legislature to have the possibilities open to them if they want to finance a portion of capital improvements with general fund monies in addition to bonds. It allows that, and it allows to fund general fund monies for capital improvement projects also without having to pass new revenue measures. We can do them, but it doesn't prohibit us. Did I make myself clear there?
I'm not sure.
Okay, how the House has it read is that in their resolve clause is that it makes major shift to fund projects by direct appropriation from the general fund in lieu of rather than in addition to. That if you wanted to go GO bond, you could go GO bond, but you could not put in any direct appropriation from the general fund. It's an either or situation.
But that's only project by project, isn't it, John?
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't seem much of a restraint.
It is to the extent that...
In other words, you're talking about if you wanted to go half cash and half bond.
Right.
On a
you
single
can't
project.
Do it. It says projects. My interpretation, it was all.
Oh, I would say it was, you know, I read it as project by project. You could bond one or you could cash one.
Yeah, that's not how I read it. How does anybody else read it?
Mel, what's it?
Well, I believe the House's intent was that it would be either all projects are done this way or none.
That's the way I read it.
Yeah.
Well, that's then you are quite right, John, because it's...
And
you know,
then
there
if
are
you
certain projects that should not be bonded, they should be direct.
And then if you read that in addition with the next clause, not only do you have an either-or situation, but you have it only if the legislature passes new revenue measures. And I don't think that, I think that hinders a person too much.
Well, I don't mind being hindered that way.
You know, one of these days, and the reason I changed it is that one of these days we're going to have to decide on a policy issue as to whether or not we want to utilize any of the existing general fund monies, purely because we're going to have to decide whether or not we're going to fund all of the requests that are in for bonds, which have taken up the total limit already. And decide eventually on what to do on the capital board. And I think you're limiting yourself, you know, in terms of your discussions of what to do, regardless of what you do at that point in time.
Well, that's next year's basically, isn't it?
Not necessarily. There's 78, so there's
well,
79 this year. Or
all I can tell you here, I've seen the experience within our borough that if you use a FOS account cash, you come out with a capital improvement that costs about 30% less than it costs the bonds. I don't know what it is. It must be psychological. And when you're paying cash, everybody seems to watch closer. Things just cost a lot less when you're paying cash than when you're paying credit cards or bonds.
Okay, well, I think that's a legitimate discussion regardless of how a person feels about the capital. And that discussion would be prohibited if you pass this resolution. Because you couldn't use any cash. If you pass the House resolution, that's why I changed it around. Anyway, that's the process that we could come into in terms of trying to determine what expenditures will be made in the budget in terms of percentages and still allow leeway for new ideas and new deletions and additions. And I don't know how you're going to resolve that last part where the resolution could be amended for unforeseeable events or emergencies.
Do you remember chapter 66?
No.
Should you be able to check it?
What's 66?
Oh, is that the one that was passed last year?
Yeah.
Oh,
oh yeah, I have it here. Okay, any questions about the whole thing? We gotta get it on.
Okay, let's get it on.
Motion?
Do you have to be amended? Yeah, but Senate Committee, Finance Committee, substitute for House of Current Resolution.
With
the amendments proposed by the chairman.
What recommendations?
I recommend, how many do pass it? Why don't we run the bus?
I prefer to put a...
Do individual recommendations.
Okay. So, individual recommendations.
A couple weeks ago, we had set up this meeting with the broadcasters as a part of the education budget. And page 88 of your short form. No.
Okay, last year they... Broadcast Commission received $2,394,800. They requested $2,686,200. Requested $2,971,800, rather, and the governor knocked them down to $2,411,700. And you have the broadcasters, I believe, from around the state. Who wants to start first?
I gave a letter, I think, yesterday to the committee. Attached to it was an analysis sheet, looking like this, and you'll find on that sheet for each station their request from the grant, from the APPC, and also the tentative allocation made by the commission for each of the stations. This chart, which had this cover letter. It was a cover letter from me to the committee, dated the 15th. It's probably in the basket. There's a memo from me dated the 15th. It should have been given to you yesterday in the basket, which has two analysis sheets attached to it on the grant program.
Okay, while he's doing that analysis, I need to make some committee assignments. Senate Bill 438, AFDC, to Senator Holman. Senate Bill 363, Individualized Reading Instruction, Senator Kropp. Senate Bill 257, Medical Leave, Senator Chilion.
What? That's title?
Senate Bill 257, Medical Leave. You got another, that's only one news.
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of them.
House Bill 104 to Orsini and Certificates of Residency. House Bill 613, Supplemental Appropriation to Workman's Comp, Senator Meehlin. 613, and Senator Meehlin, would you look at a request by Petersburg and Tolk that was in the budget last year, but they don't have any money for $8,000. I've got some material on that. Senate Bill 510, relating to the state budget and state bonding, Senator Holman. The state budget's very fine. I'll get a center budget, which we've almost got here. 510.
I won't feel slighted if you get it. Senate Bill 510?
Yeah. Senate Bill 466, Senator Killian, Special Appropriation to the Department of Health and Social Services for Mobile Dental Clinic. That's all the latest goes to the
board. We had a monster. Things are off to you. Sorry about that.
Oh, we'll start. Yeah.
Okay, well, while the analysis is...
I have
a quick give them to the
government. We're waiting for the letter. This is one of the analysis. This is on the bottom. Grant proposal by the users. By station.
Where's zero now?
That's for yours. At the very bottom, the very last group of data at the bottom, you see three figures. There's our APPC maintenance, APPCR. Those are the requests by the station. APPCP is what's proposed by the commission in their budget for the station at this time. So you have three figures down there. maintenance request by the station, the request by the station, and the proposed allocation by the commission.
Of the governor's?
Of the commission's budget, not the governor's budget.
You don't have anything with the governor's?
No, the commission has not made a reallocation at the governor's figure.
Okay, who wants to talk first? Nobody? Good evening, Drew.
That saved us quite a bit of money.
Anybody want to testify on the budget? Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, I'm Charles Northrup, General Manager for Capital Community Broadcasting here in Juneau. And we're the host station for a meeting of managers that's taking place the latter part of this week, dealing primarily with public radio network matters. And most of the people that you see around you here are managers or representatives of stations from around the state. Before I speak specifically to our concerns here at KTOO, I would like to make the point, and I think I'll be backed up by the stations who are here today, that the station's request of the commission, when it had its budget review session in September, in most cases were not agreed to by the commission, and the commission's request reflects a substantial reduction from most of the requests of the station. And subsequent to the commission's request, the governor has reduced that request by another $550,000. And I think it's sufficient to say that if the governor's figure is the figure that we end up with, that there are no stations that will end up with even a maintenance budget for the coming year. If the commission's figure is taken, I'd even question whether there'd be a maintenance capacity there. Capital Community Broadcasting operates KTOO FM and will soon operate a public television station serving the Juneau area. Most of you are also aware that we operate the Alaska Public Radio Network and Capital 78 televised coverage of the legislature. I can answer questions about any of those activities, but I want to use my time today to speak primarily for KTOO FM and television. And to try to make the point that without the base that our stations provide, the statewide activities that we're engaged in would not be possible. Also with me in the room this morning are Dennis Harris, who's the coordinator of the Public Radio Network, to answer questions if you might have about that. Bruce Theriault, who's the manager of our local radio station, to answer questions about that. In the budget process that the commission asked us to go through, we, as well as all the other stations, made a complete needs ascertainment of our community. We feel we know our community pretty well. We've done two ascertainments in the last 2 years. We've conducted two random surveys of listener and viewer preferences. We feel that we are programming to meet a large number of local needs. We provide the only native news programming in the Juneau area. We provide Filipino programming in the Juneau area. Our ascertainments pointed out that there's a severe problem with alcoholism in the Juneau area, and we've programmed specifically to that problem, and some of it in conjunction with statewide efforts being taken by committees of the legislature. We broadcast live the meetings of our local borough assembly, and again, since our ascertainment pointed out real problems in the Juneau area with juvenile crime, we're beginning to concentrate now on our programming on recreational opportunities, particularly those that might be of interest to young people. We involve our community. 30 or 40 volunteers, between 30 and 40 volunteers, are involved in the work of our station. We conduct annual marathons, membership drives, and the community support that we receive in terms of local memberships is significant in terms of the financial outlay of our station. I'd also like to make the point that on the television side of our picture, that our fiscal 78 budget request envisioned our television station being on the air only for a few months of this year. So necessarily, our maintenance budget for our television operation for fiscal 79 is going to show a significant increase just to maintain the level of operation that we'll have for a few months of this year. Neither the governor's figure nor the APPC figure will allow us to do that. The commission did approve a capital request for our television operation in conjunction with our radio operation for $25,000 for a satellite earth station to allow us to receive national public television and public radio programming. That same amount was granted in fiscal 77 to stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Bethel. We're simply requesting that we be allowed to receive the same programming that they receive. The governor seems fit to cut that from the capital appropriation, and we're seeking in any way we can to make sure that our stations are not cut off from the world, so to speak, when the satellite system is in operation by the end of this calendar year.
Excuse me, Mr. Director.
Are you saying that the budget request under the request column for Public Broadcasting Commission for your specific area is not what you requested? You requested more?
I'm not familiar with the piece of paper you're looking at, Mr. Chair.
Do you know?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What we have for the committee, Mr. Northrup, is I have given them some figures from the individual supplemental budget sheets that each of the stations submitted to my office, and I think this does reflect the station's request.
That's correct.
I think the thing that Mr. Northrup is referring to is the bottom line, the APPC proposed grant, the very bottom line on the sheet, and that's not at the level of that the station requested.
Yeah,
I think that's what he's referring to.
Yeah, you'll note that at the bottom of the column, the commission is proposing a combined grant for both radio and television, totaling $385,000. And if you look at our request, you'll see that they're considerably above that. I closed my remarks to make room for other stations. They've come a long way, and they're only here for today. We're around, and if you have further questions of us, we can answer them almost any time. By saying that I think all existing stations are in kind of a difficult position with regard to new stations. We know that public stations can be tremendous assets to the communities that they would serve if they're started in new areas. But we also know from bitter experience that once a station gets on the air and begins to find the ways in which it can serve its community, that the program funds, the funds programmed to community needs and to meet the needs that exist, become the critical item. And unless operational support increases for the existing stations, we begin to lose our effectiveness. Simply having a transmitter to put on the air doesn't quite get the job done. There's got to be some money to do relevant programming to address the problems in the community. So, while we want to support new starts, and we think that there are a lot of unserved areas.